Everyone knows the risks of drunk driving. You could get in a crash. People could get hurt or killed. Thousands of people are killed in drunk driving crashes every year. But that still doesn't stop everyone. You could get arrested. You could incur huge legal expenses, and you could possibly lose your job. We all know the consequences of drunk driving. But one thing's for sure, you're wrong if you think it's no big deal. Plan ahead, don't take chances, and don't drive drunk. Drive sober or get pulled over.
Paid for by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Hey, welcome in to the All Ball Podcast. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This week's guest is Eric Musselman. He's the head coach of Nevada. He's had an amazing life, and he's only in his 50s. And, of course, he's head coach of the Wolfpack. They're ranked 7th in the country. I'll really quickly give you my take on the pack before he joins us. The Martin twins are outstanding. They're both 23 years old. They're both kind of point forward types. Cody does all the little things. Caleb is more the star, although Caleb, not a great shooter. And, look at the Arizona State game. He struggled from three. I don't know if they have enough shooting. They're bringing Jazz Johnson. They downshift and go small. If they have enough shooting to win the whole thing. But they seem to have everything else. And then they have Jordan Caroline, who plays everything from small forward to power forward to center. I think he could be a first-round draft pick in the NFL. Dad, Simeon Rice, grandpa, of course, a star in the NFL. And he plays with the type of energy, tenacity, ferocity. He's not as good around the basket as Tony Gonzalez was, who I played with in AAU basketball, but there's some similarities there. 6'4", 6'5", thick legs, explosive, competitive. I love him. Love him. Jazz Johnson, the transfer, comes off the bench. 5'11", plays hard, can really, really shoot the basketball. He's kind of like their secret weapon. And they're still learning to play with some of the – remember, they only have three guys, Caroline and the Martin twins, that played together last year. So it's not that stunning that there have been moments in which their defense hasn't been as good as you would have liked. They do have – like their center is kind of interesting to me. You know, having watched them play and called a couple of their games, I watched Trey Porter. Trey Porter's only playing – 16 and a half minutes a game, averaging 7 and 5. Tremendous shot blocker, tremendous athlete, two-time transfer, George Mason, ODU, and now he plays at Nevada. He is diabetic, so there are some times when he doesn't have the energy, especially playing, remember, Reno's in altitude. Most of the games in the Mountain West, with the exception of San Diego State, in altitude. But great shot blocker, really good energy, and changes how they look. Then they bring Jordan Brown, another shot blocker, five-star recruit off the bench. You go with those two and then Trey Thurman, who can play some three, some four, some five, can shoot the ball pretty well from three, another transfer. Corey Henson as well can shoot it. You know, they got a team, with the exception of Jordan Brown, full of men, 22 and 23-year-old men. So I like them. But more than anything, I love the story of their head coach, Eric Musselman, who's going to join us in moments. I do think that as we start to see transfers in college basketball, you go back to last week's podcast, and I said what I said about transfers. I was watching Javon Quinterly and the disaster that he had on Instagram last night. Doesn't play. They get beat by Penn. First time in 26 games they lost to a team in the City Series. They lose at the Palestra, and he IGs out. Now you know why it was my second choice for a reason. And well, look, you got beat out by Colin Gillespie, who's a better college basketball player. May not have the upside of you, but he shoots 43% from three. He's not a great passer, but he's solid. And he started some on a national championship team last year, and you're going to have to beat him out. And, oh, yeah, by the way, Gillespie had 21 on five shots. Gillespie's offense, and they fouled out, wasn't the reason that it wasn't like you would have been better offensively. You should be better defensively, but it takes time, and nobody has any patience anymore. None. Before I get to my interview with Nevada head coach Eric Musselman, let me take a moment to tell you about Quip. There's a buzzy gift on everyone's list this year. It's called Quip, and if you get it, they'll use it twice a day, every day. If you get it, they'll say, "Did you see this on Oprah's O-list?" It's perfect for everyone with a mouth, even one as big as mine. Quip is quick. Quip is easy. Quip
is sensitive for sensitive gums like mine. It even reminds you when to switch sides of your mouth, and it's easy to pack and travel because you can stick it to a mirror and slide it off with no incident. That's why I love Quip and why they have over 5,000 verified five-star reviews. Quip looks like a big-ticket item, but it's got a stocking stuffer price, starting at just $25. So go to GetQuip, GetQUIP.com/Doug. Right now, get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack for free at GetQuip.com/Doug. GetQuip.com/Doug.
All right, let's welcome into the All Ball Podcast the head coach of the defending regular season champions of the Mountain West. And, of course, they went to the Sweet 16 last year. They're ranked number 7 in both polls this year. They're undefeated. Eric Musselman is our guest. And, Eric, thanks so much for taking – Mus, thanks so much for taking time. Here we are, I don't know, a month in the season or so, and you have kind of an older group but a different group than you've had in previous years. What outside of the wins, what's your assessment of your team so far?
Well, first of all, Doug, thanks so much for having me on. We, I think our guys have done a really good job. I think the hardest thing for us was kind of new territory, obviously coming off the Sweet 16 and being a basket away from the Elite Eight. We kind of snuck up on people, and last year was a fun year with no pressure. We went out, we were kind of the underdog, especially once we got to the NCAA tournament, and then that all switched preseason. I've been really, really proud of how the guys have had a business-like approach. They didn't let all the off-season media and accolades get to them. And now that we're, 10 games into the season, I think that's all behind us, regardless of what happens in our upcoming games. The bottom line is, what I was worried about is how are we going to get through these first 10 games with six of them being away from home, just handling the pressure, not just wins and losses, but how is a group that only had three players that were in uniform last year and a whole new group that was ranked preseason and really hadn't proved anything at all together, how would they react? And that's probably the thing that we're most proud of in this young season.
You fell behind big early to Arizona State the other night at Staples Center. You learn a ton about your team through adversity. What'd you learn in that comeback about what you had?
Well, I think the one thing is, really for the last 3 years, we've never felt that we've been out of a game. And, we were down 20-some with 9 minutes to go against New Mexico on the road a couple years ago and came back. And then obviously last year, we got down to Texas by 12 in the second half, and we were down 22 to Cincinnati in the second half. And it's just a group that that always believes that they can come back and win a game. And certainly, we want to play good out of the gate, but that doesn't always happen. And the one thing you always want your team to do is play until the last possession of the game, regardless of the score. And probably because of the character of who we have in Cody Martin, Caleb Martin, Jordan Caroline. Those are our leaders emotionally, spiritually, and also verbally. And those guys do a great job of, because there's games when your shot's not falling, or there's games when your legs are a little bit tired or you're mentally fatigued. And on those nights, you're not going to play pretty basketball all the time. And I think that's the biggest thing, Doug, with us is just the will to win. And again, it doesn't mean you're always going to win, but it certainly means that you got a fighting chance on any given night, even when your offense isn't clicking. And, sometimes we do get behind. I mean, the game against Grand Canyon, we're down 14-2 because we take some ill-advised shots and mm-hmm. we take some quick threes, but that's also what gets us back into games as well.
Eric Musselman is our guest here on the All Ball Podcast. Let's go back. You play at San Diego. You finish up with Hank Egan as your head coach, and it's pretty amazing. There's like two current head coaches in the NBA from San Diego. Of course, you and, there's a guy at St. Mary's who's another San Diego guy, seemed to be killing it. What was it about San Diego that has been able, like USD is not known for basketball. They got a nice team this year, by the way. I just called their upset of San Diego State. But what was it about that group that played for Hank Egan, especially, and maybe Brad Holland that followed, that's been this kind of quiet little wellspring of coaches.
Well, it really starts with Coach Bickerstaff. And Bernie coached and played there and then obviously went on to the Nuggets. And then Bernie brought Mike Brown into the video room with the Nuggets when he was coaching there. And my freshman year, I played for Coach Jim Bravelli. And Coach Bravelli, a lot of people forget, not only was he at the University of San Diego, but then he was an NBA assistant with Washington and with Coach Bickerstaff, and then ended up being an interim NBA head coach. So when you think of Coach Bickerstaff, Coach Bravelli being an interim NBA head coach as well as an assistant in the NBA, and then obviously Doug, Coach Egan, when he got to USD, it kind of changed where there many, many doors opened, and it's because Coach Egan coached Greg Popovich in college, and so Coach Egan becomes an assistant coach with the Spurs, and then he opens up doors for people like David Fizdale, the current head coach of the New York Knicks, and Chris Grant, who's a former general manager of the Atlanta Hawks. And so there's all these little branches that have now, come across, and guys are having great success, and Charlotte's head coaches from USD, and it really is amazing. But the thing is, it's a small fraternity, and all of us have looked out for each other in this coaching business.
And, of course, you got a chance to work, starting off working, not for your dad. Like, your dad was with the Timberwolves, and he had just finished with the Thrillers when you were a GM at, what, like 21 years old in the CBA?
Doug, my first job was actually – I went from the University of San Diego to selling tickets with the LA Clippers, and at that time, that was a very, very, very difficult job. The Clippers did not win many games. Fortunately for me, Barry Hecker was the player personnel director, and Barry, at that time, he lived in Salt Lake City, and so I got an opportunity to expand a role being Barry's assistant, because he wasn't living in the town and in the city of Los Angeles, and he was out recruiting and scouting, so to speak. I got to do a lot of the paperwork for Barry, and he gave me a great opportunity. And then from there, I went as a general manager in the old CBA, the minor leagues in Rapid City, South Dakota. And I was 22 years old. And at that time, you got to hire a coach if you're a GM. And I was fortunate enough to hire Flip Saunders, who had played for my dad. Flip was an assistant coach at the University of Tulsa.
J.D. Barnett, right? Was J.D. Barnett the coach
at
Tulsa?
Yeah, he was under J.D. Barnett, exactly, Doug.
J.D. Barnett was known as, he was like seen as a crazy person, but had unbelievable staff. Like Tubby was on that staff. I'm trying to think. There were several other guys that have become tremendous head coaches that are on J.D. Barnett, but J.D. Barnett was seen as an amazing coach, but just he was kind of back in that yeller-screamer era of coaches. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think it is. And Flip, it was interesting because Flip knew that he was going to end up getting a college head job, but he was really, really interested in the pro game and wanted to go that route, because prior to working as an assistant coach at Tulsa, Flip was at Golden Valley in Minnesota, small college, and had an incredible record. But he came, and together, both of us kind of learned the CBA ways of guys going to Europe and guys coming back and call-ups. And we turned the team around. It was 18-38 the year before to 38-18. And it was one of the funnest years I had, because Flip was a guy that was so great to be around and was such an incredible innovator from an offensive standpoint. So as a GM, I was so young and was learning from Flip, and it was an experience. For me, that was the guy that I looked up to. He played for my dad at the University of Minnesota. He wore number 14. I know exactly what his jump shot looked like, and that's what I emulated all through high school. And then you get done with college and you get to work with the guy that you looked up to so much. Your first job together was kind of like a dream come true.
All right, give me your greatest CBA discovery, guy that you saw that either played for you when you were a coach in the CBA or you acquired as a GM in the CBA that became an NBA player. Give me your Mario Elie story.
I think the one guy, and it's just because people said that he could never be a point guard, and it's actually an NBA D League. Donald Sloan was a guy that, you know, he was a backup for us. Aaron Miles blew his knee out. Donald, we had a road trip of five straight games, and Donald actually had all of his bags packed with all of his belongings, and he brought them on every road trip because he was trying to get out of the D League and go play in Europe. And then he ended up playing so well for us and ended up being a seven-year career. But he was ready to give up his NBA dream because he was a backup in the minor leagues, and he stuck with it. But there's so many guys.
I didn't think Donald Sloan was an NBA point guard. I mean, I covered him at Texas A&M, and I didn't see. I know the game is different, and he was a great winner playing for Terge, right? But he wasn't a great shooter. He went right almost every time, but he was tougher than hell. And he was a winner. And it's different to be a backup point guard than it is to be a starting point guard, right? Like, you have to, toughness maybe even above skill, and then knowing kind of who you are. But it's really remarkable that you could see him. I love that he brought all of his stuff with him, right? And that's part of the part I tell people all the time, that there's this push for high school kids to go right to the minor leagues. And I'm like, look, I know you don't want that, because even though, look, you started and established your career back in the old CBA, you can attest to this. It's when you're playing the G League or the CBA, whatever, no one wants to be there long term. There is no investment in long term. Everybody is renting month to month or week to week. Whereas in college sports, there is an investment in the process, in the place. People do want to stay, whether it's 4 or 5 years, or coaches would like to stay longer. Sometimes the business pushes you to a different place. I don't like the idea of sending a high school kid to somewhere that no one really wants to be.
And I agree with you, Doug. I mean, I say it all the time, like, to think that, you know, a student athlete would want to go live that life not knowing how hard it really is, and the bus trips. And, you know, people talk about development, and in the D League, you don't have much practice time because you're playing almost every night, and then the nights you're not playing, the travel becomes so hard from a player development standpoint, you have so much more time in college to work with guys. Even though we have restrictions on the time, you still have way more time than what a D-League player would get, just because of the difficult travel and the number of games you play. But there's so many neat, you know, relationships and stuff that I feel like I was exposed to in the minor leagues. Some of the guys that played for us, like Leon Wood, turned into an NBA ref, and Keith Smart played for us in Rapid City and ended up being a head coach in the NBA. And Connor Henry ended up being a great D-League coach and now works as a scout for the Timberwolves. And college coaches like Craig Neal and Wayne Tinkle played for us in Rapid City, and Lester Connor, who was a longtime NBA assistant. There's, you know, the relationships are absolutely incredible with guys, and there was, you know, there was less NBA teams in that time, but really, really neat relationships. And I think, you know, other success stories that you had a part or a hand in, like Jeremy Lin was sent down to us from Golden State, and Jeremy really struggled in pick and rolls, trying to go left and make decisions on guys rolling or popping. And then you fast forward like a couple months after he's with you with the Reno Bighorns, and Linsanity happens. And Gerald Green was a guy that absolutely did not want to play in the D League. And through phone call after phone call after phone call, he passed up a deal in China, and he got called up to the Nets. And then, you know, since then he's stuck in the league. And so all those things are really what basketball is all about, is the relationships and then seeing guys go on and have success.
What for people who don't remember your dad as a coach, there are moments which your dad is remembered for. You know, they used to do, my dad told me, they used to do, like, didn't they play Sweet Georgia Brown when he was first in Minnesota? They play like Sweet Georgia Brown. They do they'd almost do the Harlem Globetrotters warm-up.
They did. Doug, and it was they played Sweet Georgia Brown. It's on YouTube. If you actually, you know, Google, you know, Bill Musselman, University of Minnesota warm-up, it started at Ashland College in Ohio. where he put together this warm-up with players learning to juggle, unicycle guys, guys that were even on scholarship. He put a guy on scholarship at the University of Minnesota that was a unicycle rider.
No.
And he did. True story. Mike Munson was his name. There was a guy named Crazy George Schauer who played both at Ashland and the University of Minnesota. And George was not a good player, but he was still to this day one of the famous basketball spinners of a ball or ball handler. And he actually still works for the Dallas Mavericks. But they had a warm-up that was kind of insane, and he was kind of a showman way before that was something that was looked upon, and they sold out Williams Arena and had great teams. But he was known for that warm-up, and that's cool to hear that your dad used to tell you that story.
No, so my dad's – my dad was like, my dad loves Sweet Georgia Brown, and so I'll tell you, I'd love to just – and this is kind of what this podcast is. Like, look, we could talk about your team, and I want to talk about your journey personally, but – I don't know, like, I fell in love with basketball because, one, I like playing it. But I used to, in Southern California, my dad, he got fired in 84 with Tex Winter. And he went up and he was a volunteer assistant for Oregon State for Ralph Miller. Lanny Van Eeman said, you got to come up here, coach for Coach Miller, and, you know, you'll get a job somewhere else the next year. And he ended up, you know, coaching. He's supposed to coach in the 6'4" and under league, right? The IBA IBA was supposed to be the 6'4" and under league, and he would coach in the NBA summer league here at LMU, and he would coach us in AAU. And in Orange County, like, we had good players, but in order to get a little bit better players, you had to get a couple kids from LA or Bay. We had the J.R. Henderson from Bakersfield, the Waltons from San Diego, and a lot of these kids, the parents wouldn't drive them to practice, so he'd pick me up from school. And we'd go drive to, you know, Compton or East Los Angeles or somewhere in South Central, pick up a kid, go to practice, meet everybody, practice, and then go take him home. And so he would tell me stories about basketball. So he told me about Sweet Georgia Brown. He told me about your dad. And he also told me about the fight. Now, there was a terrible fight with Ohio State, right? And part of what made your dad a great coach was that he got kids to play remarkably hard and really, really aggressive. And, you know, some would say, you know, there's that line there, right, where you don't want to be overly aggressive. But there was a nasty fight between them and Ohio State, wasn't there?
Yes, it was. Luke Woody was involved in the fight. And, you know, it was interesting because both teams, University of Minnesota at the time and Ohio State, Doug, were really, really good basketball teams. And my dad was from Ohio. There was actually a player on the University of Minnesota, Keith Young, who was from Columbus, Ohio, and Ohio State did not recruit him. And there was an incident at halftime where a Minnesota player was spit on as they were leaving the floor. And, unfortunately, a fight did ensue at the end of the game. And, there was a lot of things that people didn't know that kind of led up to that fight. But it happened, it's that one incident is probably what drove my dad to go to the pro game.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, yeah.
He left the University of Minnesota and went and worked as a head coach in the ABA for the San Diego Sales, and that team folded because they found out about 8 games into the ABA season that they were not going to be part of the NBA merger. And that following year was when, you know, the Spurs and the Pacers and the Nets entered into the NBA, and the teams that were remaining in the ABA, they all folded. And so the owners found that out. They didn't want to continue the year. And so I learned at a really young age, because at that time I was in junior high. We had, you know, my dad had left a really stable situation for the pro game. And I'm sitting at dinner table one night, and my dad's out of a job, and my mom is upset because she loved living in Minnesota. And so, you know, what happens next? And Virginia Squires hired my dad about 2 weeks after the sale folded. And so he was off to Virginia, and our family was then separated. And as you know, Doug, when your dad, you know, when Bob was coaching, you you were probably not with him all the time.
No.
And that's just kind of what happened.
Yeah. No, my brother's birthday is in March, early March. And I remember that it wasn't until, I think, 86. So my brother was 72. So that's like his 14th birthday. I think, honestly, was the first birthday my dad was ever around my brother for. Like, literally, it wasn't until he was 14 years old, because back then you had 18 scholarships, and the second season was over, you had to get on the road, and he had this Honda Civic, and he would go and drive and go all across the country and find more players. He was the head coach of the Minnesota Timberwolves when they were an expansion team, and here's what I remember. And this is what I remember from pump camp when I was a kid, was – they used to talk about your dad and go, "Now he's a great coach, but does anybody know he's actually running a 1-3-1? Is that accurate? Is that he was? It was that was back in the days of the old illegal defense rules where you couldn't play zone, right? And they used to give the ball to Michael Jordan, you know, Kevin Lockery gave it to him on one side of the court, put everybody else in the other, and your dad was like, "The hell with it, I'm just going to find a creative way of running a 1-3-1." Is that an accurate recollection?
Yes, it is, Doug, and it was interesting because when we kind of presented it to the team. You know, because of the illegal defensive rules, my dad would word it that we're playing a, you know, hyperbolical transitional floating zone man-to-man. And then Flip Saunders ended up, when the rules changed and you were allowed to play zone in the NBA, which you're still currently allowed to, Flip ended up using that same zone defense, which was basically a matchup zone, but out of a 1-3-1 look. And, you know, because I was with my dad, Tom Thibodeau was an assistant coach with the Timberwolves team, and he did some really, really unique, strategic things. For instance, one night he had Randy Brewer, who was 7'4" guard, Magic Johnson, and Magic was obviously a point guard for the Lakers, and it worked perfectly for us. He basically had Randy Brewer at 7'4" back completely off of Magic and try to take away all of Magic Johnson's post-ups and force him to shoot three-point shots, which at that time, you know, Magic was an incredible post-up player at the point guard position and not a very consistent three-point shooter. So he thought outside the box, although a lot of people thought he was old school. When you think about the warm-up, you think about doing things like having Randy Brewer guard Magic, or you think about the 1-3-1 when zone defenses were not legal in the NBA. He was pretty creative and very, very innovative.
This is obviously a question that I think of oftentimes during times. I lost my dad 4 years ago. You lost yours 18 years ago. You've been through a lot, right? From being 2 times an NBA head coach, bouncing around as the college system, but now you've clearly made a mark in college. How often do you think of him?
Probably the same time you think, you know, as much as you think about your dad, Doug. It never changes. It's pretty interesting when I had my press conference, the first NBA job I had with Golden State. I think I was like 36 or something, and so I was in my brand new office, getting ready for the press conference to start. My mom was there with me, along with one of my sons, and I broke down crying about 15 minutes before the press conference because, you know, my goal and what I wanted to do is I wanted to be the first father-son head coaches in the NBA. And at that time, you know, we were the only father-son head coaches, and since then, the Malones have done it, but I really wanted that as a goal. And when you're in high school and you say you want to be an NBA head coach, you know, your dad's even rolling his eyes like, "Hey, that's awesome, but it's really hard. You got to have a lot of breaks." And it was a really emotional time for me. And, you know, the hardest thing when you lose a parent or a loved one, because for me, my dad was not only my idol, but he was my best friend. And someone that I talked to every single day from the day that I left my first day going to the University of San Diego as a freshman. Not a day went by where I didn't pick up the phone and talk to my dad. Then all of a sudden, sickness happens and he's gone in a short time. And the one thing, I just hope he's watching what's going on, because it hasn't always been easy. You get these two jobs at a young age in the NBA, and then you kind of got to resurrect your career and figure out what direction it's going to go. And, you know, some people that are good friends of mine, like Tom Thibodeau, Tom was very frustrated not getting a head job until he was into his 50s. But yet when he got that job, you know, he was ready for it through working for great coaches. And sometimes younger coaches, you know, you climb up the ladder so quickly, and then all of a sudden the rug can get pulled out of you. But the great thing about that is when you get it back, the appreciation becomes tenfold.
One thing you learned from Chuck Daly.
Well, shoot, Doug, that would take me. He was a second father to me.
What was it? Well, how about this? How about this? This is he's fascinating to me. Okay, because he didn't play, and I'm always fascinated. Like, you were a player, I played. Like, I do think it's. I've always had this, not negative perception, but I've struggled. The few coaches I've struggled most with were with guys that didn't play. Like, I don't know there. Whereas I think there's a feel. Chuck Daly didn't play. On the other hand, he was great in college and even better in the pros. And I mean, people forget he was the coach of the Dream Team, and there was no real arguing there in terms of when he got the job. No, he's like, well, somebody else should get it. He had an amazing way of handling superstars, and I'm just fascinated by Chuck Daly. He feels like the least studied all-time great coach I can think of. I don't know why that is. Like, when we point to great coaches, we talk obviously about Phil Jackson. We talk about Larry Brown. I think some people talk about Rudy Tomjanovich. You know, obviously Red Auerbach. I mean, kind of we go through them. I don't feel like Chuck Daly, and you, like you said, you were very close to him, and you coached with him. Are there any nuggets that you resonate the most with you?
Well, number one, you're right about handling egos. The most incredible coach that I've ever seen with rapport with his players, an incredible people person. He could predict the future. He would not just in a game, but in a season. His big thing was there's always going to be turbulence in every season. Kind of like a pilot encounters turbulence when he flies a plane. And Coach Daly always said, you know, my job is to try to land the plane safely when the season ends. And he, there's just so many limiting. For instance, there was a night when Vernon Maxwell, who was on that Magic team, was struggling. And I kept saying, Coach, we got to get Vernon out of the game. He's killing us. And a couple minutes went by. And Coach Daly called the timeout. When we went to huddle before we met with the team, he winked at me and he said, Mus, I'm going to show you how you take Vernon Maxwell out of a game. And so we go into the huddle, and he diagrams a play for Vernon. The guys get up to go out of the huddle, and he says, hey, Vernon, I'm going to sub you out, and we're going to put Darrell Armstrong in. And Vernon's happy because he thought there was a play going to be run for him out of the timeout. And so Vernon sits on the end of the bench, and then Chuck leans back and he goes, now, do you know what would have happened if I would have set a sub down, live ball situation? He's on the other side of the floor. He got to walk all the way down,
right,
90 feet to the bench,
right,
and he'd be mumbling under his breath.
Right.
And so he had all these little things, Doug, that he was phenomenal with. Horace Grant hated to practice, and so Coach Daly went to him in training camp. And he said, hey, Horace, here's the deal. I know the year before, Coach Daly, he's talking, the year before you got here, you wouldn't practice. Do this for me. Let me pull you out of practice when I know we're going to do something that you don't want to do or that's going to be strenuous on your body. I'll get you ready to play the games. You got to go through stretching. You got to suit up. You can't sit over there and ice. And so he had all these little ways that he dealt with guys, and he was masterful in getting everybody to buy in to the good of the team.
That's amazing. Amazing. When you were with the Hawks, it was Lon Kruger. It didn't work. Did it not work because he was a college guy? Because he was I've known Lon played for my dad. My dad was the freshman coach and assistant varsity coach at Kansas State. I nearly went to play for Lon at Florida. I remember he brought in some of his Florida guys, and I felt like that was a mistake. Why didn't it work with Lon Kruger, who's literally won everywhere he's been? Like, he has an amazing – Lon Kruger has an amazing track record. You go back, you're like, man, he won there, he won there, he won there, he won there. With the exception of the NBA, why didn't it work?
Well, first of all, he is literally the nicest man that I've ever met and the best person to work for. There wasn't a day that went by, Doug, that Coach Kruger did not allow me to go pick my sons up at the bus stop when they were very, very young. An incredible people person, an incredible basketball coach. But we had no talent. I mean, we drafted guys like DeMar Johnson in the lottery, Deion Glover in the first round, Cal Bowdler out of Old Dominion in the first round. And so we, you know, and all those guys.
It wasn't
S&O's,
it was Jimmy's and, it was Jimmy's and Joe's, right? I mean,
we had no players. Yeah. And I felt so bad for Coach Kruger because it was not only a young team, but it was a team that lacked talent. In reality, you know, we had Jimmy Jackson, who was a really good player, obviously, and we had Jason Terry, who was a rookie and who was trying to convert from an off guard to a point guard. And obviously, management, you know, they always like you to play the young guys. And so Coach Kruger was just put, you know, in what I thought was an impossible situation for anybody. You could add Chuck Daly, Phil Jackson, Red Auerbach, all on the staff, and that roster was not going to win. And so, and you know what? Unfortunately, for several college coaches that are great X and O's coaches, they've been put in those positions.
Right.
And it also happens with young coaches that are NBA assistants. Is sometimes you get saddled with a roster that you know that nobody can win with. And the NBA, you got to have players to win. You obviously need it in college too, but if you don't have players that can manufacture shots in the NBA, you got zero chance to win it at a consistent level.
When you took over with the Golden State Warriors, your problem was you guys were just too young, right? I mean, that was like Gilbert's like half crazy, but super, super talented. But he was, I'm going to say, like 21 at the time. Jason Richardson, 21 at the time. You know, Troy Murphy, who I think would have been better now than he was then, right? Anton Jameson was just coming into his prime. Like, there were some other flaws within the roster, but was youth a big part of the issue?
I mean, it was, but we, you know, the interesting thing, Doug, is we, you know, we had a 17-game improvement from the year before in year one. We were second in the NBA in scoring because I felt like we had to have an identity. We knew we had to try to somehow, you know, get free agents if ownership was willing to pay guys and have a style that people wanted to play in to add to our incredibly young, youthful team that was talented and fun. They were a great group of guys to be around. You mentioned Arenas and Troy Murphy at the four and Jay Rich at the two and Jameson at the three. But what happened was, after the first year, we had a slight change in management. Some new guys were coming into the front office, and Gilbert Arenas walks and goes as a free agent to Washington. And then Antoine Jameson, who was a guy that I was extremely close with and had high character, he and Eric Dampier both get traded. And they get traded for Avery Johnson, who's in the last year of his contract, Nick Van Exel, who was dealing with a ton of injuries and was at the end of his career, and Popeye Jones, who was in the end of his career. And then the guy that I had relied on as a locker room piece, connection to the coaching staff, was Earl Boykins. And Earl was from Cleveland, Ohio, where I had spent some time. And then Earl Boykins was let go via free agency, and Speedy Claxton was brought in. And so this fabric of connected coach and player, it was gone. It was missing. And so our second year, we went from 38 wins to 37 wins, still respectable for where the Warriors were at that time. And then there was a new general manager. Chris Mullen came in as a GM, and Gary St. Jean, who had hired me, was let go. And in the NBA, obviously, when there's a new general manager,
bringing on their
things
own guys
are going to happen.
Right. I remember I was reading up, and I know you had Hank Egan as your assistant one year. You had Fizz as a young assistant as well. But you also, Jim Boylan was your assistant, wasn't he, with the Warriors 1 year?
Yes, he was. Jim Boylan was with us and handled a lot of our defensive stuff. And then, you know, it's just so interesting. So many of the guys that, you know, Keith Smart was on that staff. And to see guys go on, I mean, Keith Smart was the head coach. He was on that staff. Boylan was on that staff.
But I've asked about Boylan because he just gets the Bulls job and they get embarrassed and he wants them, you know, he wants them to practice for 2 hours, which is kind of how we all grew up. But the NBA, as you point out with Chuck Daly, is different. Like, you got to be careful, you know, you got to be careful in terms of how much conflict you cause, especially when you just get the job. It's really interesting to watch what's kind of going on. Different teams, different NBA cultures, when you're trying to build toughness and a winning mentality and hardworking mentality. That, you know, since spending time with you and being a head coach in college, he's also spent time with Greg Popovich. Like, his ability, I'll see if his ability to stick through this thing with Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, you bring up the word conflict or – you know, that's where guys like Chuck Daly separate themselves, is their ability to kind of toe that line of getting your team to play hard. But in the middle of an NBA season, it is really difficult to have a two and a half hour practice. Guys are tired and they're not used to that. And, you know, I think that, you know, a guy like Coach Thibodeau gets away with it, has success with it, whatever word you want to use, because that's who he is, and he's got a team from the very beginning who understands in training camp that this is how we're going to operate. When you do that in the NBA midseason, it becomes very, very difficult. I went to Memphis with Coach Mike Fratello early November after the NBA season already started, when Hubie Brown had retired from the Grizzlies, and I can tell you that there's a very, very fine line with, and it was just Mike Fratello and I were the only two new ones. Everybody else stayed on the coaching staff, and Coach Fratello and I met a lot alone because we were, you know, the two new ones on that staff, and he talked a lot, Doug, about how he wanted to slowly progress into his philosophy. And he was friends with Hubie Brown and had great respect for him. And so he did not want to change a lot really quickly, even though there were some things that eventually he wanted to get to that were different philosophically. And so it's a balancing act that you've got to have as a coach, especially when you come in mid-year.
You got the job with the Sacramento Kings. It only lasted a year. When it was over, was there ever this thought, I'm not going to get back? Like, I'm not – I mean, what's – you know, it's like you can lose one job in the NBA because, as you said, a lot of times you take your first job, you don't have talent, and then you take the – back when you took the Kings job, that thing was a mess. Everybody knew it was a mess. It went through 5 years of being a mess until now they're fairly stable. But when you lost the Kings job, did you think this might not happen for me again?
I did. No question, Doug. I think that, you know, the Warriors – situation for me, because up until a couple months ago, I still had a home in the Bay Area. Last night, I went and watched my son, who's got his senior year in high school over there. You know, when I go work out in the Bay Area, I still wear my Warriors stuff. Warriors fans are incredible. I love going into their arena and watching them play. And Sacramento, just a completely different situation. You know, I felt like I failed because it was only 1 year. We didn't, you know, they had great success under Coach Adelman, and obviously Rick is a Hall of Fame type coach. And I learned, you know, when you replace a great coach, it's a lot harder than when you replace a program or an organization that's really, really down. Like, the Warriors were so far down. It was just about, hey, how do we get them to play hard? How do we get respect to the referees? How do we get the Warrior brand to be respectable? And when you go into a situation like the Kings, like, they had very laid-back practices before I got there. And they had success doing it. They had success with certain superstars not even showing up for shoot-arounds. So when I was hired, the Maloof family actually was intrigued by what we could do as a staff based on discipline. But then once we got in there and we expected everybody to come to practice and show up on time, the Maloofs actually kind of wanted the players to enjoy a situation. And if a guy showed up late, it was cool. It was all right. And so that was a hard.
Everybody says they want everybody says they want discipline until they actually have to go through discipline, right? And that kind of
exactly.
You know, and this is really what Boylan's going through is Paxton has told him, like, hey, I got your back. You know, this is what we need. We need to get back to hard practice and being tougher. And we're like, all right, fine. And then all of a sudden now the players push back. You're like, wait a second, whose side do you have in this one? And, you know, back when the Maloofs were in charge, you know, here they are spending half their time in Vegas and hanging out with the players in Vegas, and that makes it kind of a toxic job to keep, no?
It was really difficult, and that's why there were so many coaches during the short time frame after Coach Rick that were not successful, from Reggie Theus to myself to Keith Smart. Just so many guys that really struggled there. But getting back to your question, Doug, at that point, I knew that I still had 3 years coming from a pay standpoint. I had just gone through a recent divorce, and my thing was, you know what, how do I just become a dad? How do I connect with my two sons? There was missed time when I was in Memphis as an assistant coach with the Grizzlies, and my sole focus was I want to hang out with my kids. I don't want to miss any games. I don't want to miss a little league game. I want to be an assistant coach on my son's little league team. And I went and did all that. And then after 2 years, going into my third year, I was in carpool lane dropping my oldest son off at junior high. And I looked around, and it was a lot of moms that weren't working in a pretty affluent area of Danville, California. And I was the only dad because I knew that there were so many people at work at that time. And I said, you know what? I mean, I've reconnected with my sons. My sons want me to work. And then it was actually my current wife, Danielle, who I'd met in that three-year time frame. And she said, hey, you love coaching. And she actually kind of sacrificed her own career for me to go back and coach in the D-League with the Reno Bighorns. And I can promise you, Doug, that my pay with the Reno Bighorns was not even half of what she was making at the time. And she sacrificed and would get on a plane and go do her work in L.A. while we were in Reno. But, yeah, I knew two times being an NBA head coach, I did a lot of research on how many coaches – get a third opportunity at that level to be a head coach, and it's very few. Terry Stotts is one of the few guys that got a third opportunity without a ton of wins and losses in his first two stops. And so I knew, you know, and that's when I decided after 2 years in the D-League, we had two great years in the D-League, and I did not get the coaching call-up as a head coach. I did have some assistant coaching opportunities, but wanted to be a head coach, and then that's how this door got open to the collegiate game.
And, look, you worked for a good man, but one had that up until they re-upped your contract. You know, Nevada didn't have a ton of money. Obviously you guys are as good in comparison to the rest of the country as anyone could have possibly hoped, but is this how you thought it would be? Did you think it would have to be a bunch of transfers and you know, kind of mismatched parts? I mean, you guys don't actually shoot the three that well. Like, is this, if I was to ask you honestly, 2015, Doug Knuth announces you as head coach, and fast forward to today, and you're a top 10 team, is this the path you thought it would take Nevada to be back?
I think the first way to answer that, Doug, I think the highest my dad's team was ever ranked was like 12th. And again, that's my idol. And I'm as an assistant at Arizona State, and I'm an assistant at LSU with great facilities and great boosters and name brand. And so in those three short years as an assistant coach, I'm thinking it's really hard to get in the top 25. Like, when we got in the top 25 at those two places, like, it was a celebration. And then, you know, when you're at those schools, you figure out how hard it is just to get into the NCAA tournament, let alone win a game. And so to say that, yeah, when Doug Knuth and President Johnson made the decision to hire and to give us an opportunity, it was my first time as a head coach in college. I hadn't proven myself as a recruiter. Basically in my previous stops at LSU and Arizona State, recruiting was, you know, if I helped in that area, great, but that's not why I was on those staffs. It was from an X and O standpoint, player development on floor stuff, more so than anything recruiting wise. But we did have a plan. I was really lucky that I got to be an assistant coach before a head coach. I would have failed miserably, Doug, if I would have had an opportunity without the assistant coaching role. I probably would have lasted 1 or 2 years. But I got to see things I liked, things that I might tweak. And so it was great. And I felt like, how do we get as good as we can be in year four, knowing that college is somewhat of an unspoken four-year cycle? And how could we be as good as we possibly could as quickly, but yet with sustainability? And so we are really, really fortunate to get two Pac-12 commits in Lindsey Drew and Cameron Oliver in year one. And people forget that those two guys, those two incoming freshmen, were really the springboard to all this, because the Jordan Carolines and the Marcus Marshalls, those guys all sat out the first year. And obviously in year two, to have a guy like Caroline come and play and changes things. But we wanted to get incoming freshmen and we wanted to get transfers. And we were able to do that in year one with Drew and Oliver. And then we were able to do that year two with DeVerl Ramsey, who has since transferred, as well as Josh Hall, who has since transferred, along with the transfers. And then obviously getting Jordan Brown as a five-star kind of changed us from a perception standpoint. The landscape of highly recruited players and what Nevada could potentially do.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the transfers. I mean, Cam Oliver was with my brother at Oregon State for, I think it was 3 days before he, I think that's what it was. He was literally there 3 days, and then he's like, nah, this is not for me, and then he ends up playing for you and being everything you possibly could have hoped for. But you mentioned guys leaving. Like, look, you've been through this. This is the longest you've stayed anywhere since, I'm going to say, Rapid City, right? And so how do you handle that? How do you handle all of the moving parts, which a lot of the old school, longtime college guys, I think it hurts fans, because fans, you're like, wait, who's playing where now? That's very hard. And a lot of the old school coaches are like, this is crazy, all the movement. It seems like you function a little bit better in chaos. You've had a new staff, I think, every year you've been. How do you function in that chaos when so many others struggle?
I think the biggest thing, Doug, and you can attest to it, is when you're in the minor league, it's chaos every day. It's all right, your best player gets called up. You got to readjust your offense, your defense. Oh, by the way, 2 days later, another player gets called up. And then a week and a half later, your third best player goes to Europe. And so I think I do operate really well in the chaos, just because that's the life that I had for so long. But when I grew up, when you grew up, there weren't a ton, although I know you did, there weren't a ton of transfers. Like when I played at USD in 4 years, we had one player transfer, but obviously with over 800 players now, it's a different landscape. And it's so interesting because last year Johnny Jones was on our staff, and that's who I worked with at LSU. And Coach Jones had so many highly recruited players that he was able to land right out of high school. And, you know, he would laugh at me and say, Coach, you keep talking about, you know, all these transfer recruits. We got to get high school guys. And then Coach Jones gets the head coaching job at Texas Southern. And I look at his roster.
He's
now.
He's got all
and
transfers.
His whole roster,
transfers.
They're all transfers. But I think it's just the nature of where our sport is, and it's not just basketball. I mean, you look at all the football, college grad transfer quarterbacks. Some guys that had no opportunity at other places, and then they go to, it could be another Power 5 school, and they end up turning their career around and opening up, you know, new doors to play in the NFL. And so the same thing is happening at this college level as well.
Why wasn't Fennis Dembo as good as advertised? You coached him.
Fennis Dembo was on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and probably people our age, Doug, remember that. He was Fennis Dembo was a character. On that Rapid City team, I had both Fennis Dembo and Derek Chevious, and Derek was known as the Band-Aid man. He would put a Band-Aid somewhere on his body prior to every game, and he would spend 20 minutes in front of the mirror strategically deciding where he wanted to put it. If he didn't play well in the first half, the Band-Aid would change to another spot. But both Fennis Dembo and Derek were two of the all-time great characters. Fennis Dembo did not stick in the NBA, I would say, because he was 6'4", lacked lateral speed, was a very strong player physically, but just from a defensive standpoint, laterally, did not have what the NBA level looks for.
What was Manute Bol like to coach?
Oh, Manute Bol was awesome. He the only problem was when he played for Coach Don Nelson, Coach Nelson loved him to shoot the three ball. When he shot the three ball for me with the Florida Beach Dogs in West Palm Beach, I would cringe. But he was a fun-loving guy. Obviously, prior to me getting him, he had all this NBA experience and he had NBA money. And I would say Manute Bol was the most generous person financially with his teammates than anybody I've ever seen.
You had people forget you had Jeremy Lin the year before Lin Sanity. Now I called his college game and I liked him, and he almost beat UConn kind of by himself. But if you would have told me that he would have Lin Sanity, and granted it's since the knee injuries, come back down to earth, he's more of a bench player, you know, guy comes off the bench. But did you know that Jeremy Lin had in him what we've seen in him in moments in the NBA?
It's really interesting because, you know, when the Warriors sent him down, I was unfamiliar with his game because he had not gotten much NBA burn, and I had not watched him in college much. Jeremy Lin, when he was completely healthy, when we had him, his nose for loose balls, his ability to rebound the ball and push it on the break, and his ability to dribble drive with his right hand and get to the cup or get fouled, far surpassed anybody in the D-League. Now, he wasn't a great shooter.
Right.
He wasn't a good ball handler going to his left hand. But He did a few things that were really special. And as you know, Doug, like the key to the NBA is can you do one or two things that are great? And if you can, people find a niche for you. And because he has good size.
And some of it's also timing and who you play for. There's a couple things. For you, do you only do those things you do well? Like a lot of guys, like my thing was I couldn't shoot. And I got to this point where I'm like, all right, I'm going to prove to people I could shoot. Like, no, we know you can't shoot, but you can really just pass. Just right? So you struggle with that. On the other hand, remember when he had Lin Sanity, he played for the perfect coach in D'Antoni. And they didn't have Melo for that time period. So there was nobody calling for the ball in the lane. He had Tyson Chandler, like greatest teammate ever, who just screen roll, right? They didn't have Amari Stoudemire either, so there's nobody who else needs the ball, and he could play through turnovers. And he was also a high turnover guy, even though he would make a lot of plays, he would make a lot of negative plays, and D'Antoni let him play through it. So it's a lot about knowing yourself, but also having a coach that sees what you have and kind of puts you in the right system for what you have. Fair?
I don't think there's any doubt. That's more than fair. I look back at a guy like Sidney Lowe who couldn't shoot, but he played for my dad. My dad wanted Sidney just to run the offense, didn't want his point guard taking shots. And so that was a perfect marriage for Sidney Lowe to play in the NBA. And he probably doesn't really make the NBA, you know, if that's not the case. And I look at a guy like Scottie Brooks at his size, and you know, Doug, growing up in Southern California, I mean, people never thought Scottie Brooks was going to play in the NBA when he was at Irvine, and he left TCU because he got homesick and wanted to go back to Southern California.
No, he was a Modesto guy.
Exactly, yeah. But playing at Irvine,
yeah.
You know, people thought he was a really good college player, but because he had this incredible toughness and grit,
yep,
it fit perfectly with my dad, and he played great with an expansion team. And then Philly picks him up in the expansion draft, and he has an NBA career. So it's I think you're right, really fit player in a system and player with certain coaches really work out for the player.
Last thing, and I think, you know, how you use Jordan Caroline playing often as your center, perfect example of that. How you use the Martin twins, and the fact that at your level, you know, they didn't get those opportunities when they're at NC State to handle the ball as much as they have and to have a coach who puts a system around them. Last thing, I know you got to go. Have you realized where the Final Four is this year?
I have, because I still have family.
I know.
In Minneapolis.
Okay,
so
here's the question. I mean, like, look, to take Nevada to the Final Four would be incredible. It'd be incredible. To take Nevada to the Final Four in the Twin Cities, in that dome, where your dad was a college coach, your dad was a pro coach, what, I mean, there would have to be a little bit of special meaning to doing it there, wouldn't it?
I would think so, but as you know better than anybody, the key is, how do we win our next game? How do we win the game after that? And the one thing that's, you know, that I think is really important for us and for our team is, how do you win the next game? And then how do you keep in perspective that we still got to figure out a way to get into that tournament?
Sure.
'Cause in the Mountain West, we don't know. There might only be one team in that, you know, in our conference. And we have to put ourselves in a position where, number one, we make the tournament. And then if that is the case, then how do you put yourself, obviously, in the best position to get as high a seed? And it all becomes matchups. And once you get there, there's so much luck involved. And we saw that last year. I mean, we had matchups that worked for us. Texas has Mo Bamba and at 7'2" or whatever, and we have a center at 6'5". And so it was a good matchup for us. And we just got to worry about, how can we win this conference? Because it's going to be really hard when we go on the road, for sure, with the travel and not many charter flights. We got our work cut out for us the rest of these next 20 games.
No, I know. I know. And I know that you focus on every game. And, of course, you got break coming up. And so you got to worry about how often do we go 2-a-days, whatever. The second I knew we were going to talk, I was thinking about Minneapolis, thinking about your pops, and thinking about what it would mean for him to see you on that floor with your team, and what an amazing kind of journey it's been. So I appreciate you encapsulating as much of it as time permitted, and thanks so much for your time, and I wish you nothing but health and success this year with you and your family. And thanks for joining us on the pod.
No, thank you so much, Doug. And I got to tell you before we get off, your dad had such an impact on all coaches, and especially coaches my age and older. What your family's done in basketball is really, really cool. It's had such an impact on so many people. You and your brother probably don't even know, and I had to get that in before we get off. And I'd love to do it again with you sometime.
Yeah, we'll do it again. There's a bunch of other stuff I wanted to get to. And by the way, my brother told me to not tell anybody, but he did, you know, he interviewed obviously for the job when you got it, and he said you told him he was the first call he made. Your first call you made was to offer him to come be on your staff. And
told me no, that was the problem, yeah. But I did try.
No, he's a good one, but obviously they made an incredible hire, and you've done as good a job as anyone could have thought you've done. You've obviously, you know, overachieved based upon anybody's reasonable expectations. Nothing but success to you. Say hi to Danielle for me, and we'll talk soon.
Sounds great. Thanks again, Doug.
Right, look, I could go through a run-through of Kevin Durant and his interviews. I could talk about LeBron James and how the Lakers are changing and evolving, and maybe Brandon Ingram becomes an even more viable trade piece as they've played as well or better without him. Or how interesting it is that the media is buying into the Clippers going after going to get Kawhi Leonard or Kevin Durant. But I don't know. That discussion, that talk with Eric Musselman was so good. We'll just leave it at that. You check back in next week. Make sure you download, subscribe, and rate our podcast. Check out the daily Doug Gottlieb Show, where we talk about all of these topics. At Gottlieb Show, you can follow me on Twitter. Listen on Sirius XM Channel 203. That's on XM 217 on Sirius. Listen to us 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific. Go to foxsportsradio.com for any of our hundreds of affiliates that are growing nationwide. Thanks so much for listening. This has been All Ball.